Hello and welcome to The Wound Doctors, a podcast series dedicated to the study and improved treatment of wounds. These episodes are brought to you by ConvaTec, pioneering trusted medical solutions to improve the lives they touch. My name's Rod Murray and it's good to be back for the 2023 season of The Wound Doctors. Now, this is going to sound a bit obvious to say, but wounds are a medical condition and often they are a result of or related in some way to other medical conditions. So on today's episode, we're going to meet somebody who has a veritable smorgasbord of medical conditions, and due to numerous surgeries resulting from that, plenty of experience with wounds. To do the honours of introducing our wound doctor's guest today, let me bring in the wound doctor herself, Frances Henshaw. Fran, Happy New Year. What a guest you've conjured up for our first episode of 2023.
Happy New Year, Rod. Yeah, I think I've played a blinder here, if I may say so myself. I happened to be on LinkedIn one day, just posting up something to do with work, and I came across Samantha Moss. And Samantha Moss is a person who has a whole plethora of chronic diseases and has really got an amazing story about how she has coped with life and actually, you know, not become a person who has let her health conditions ruin her life, but she's kind of learned to live with them. And I think that's so inspirational. And I think there's so many lessons to be learned as for us health professionals of how we actually interact with these people. So, Sam, welcome to the Wound Doctors.
Thank you so much. It's a real honour and pleasure to be here. Thanks for finding me.
Well done to Fran. Shades of Dean Clifford, who we spoke to a few months back, I feel, Fran. Dean was one who had EB and the trauma that he had to go through every day just to be able to walk around in the dressings he had to
Yeah, put. 4 hours of doing his wound dressings every day. I remember that.
I think Samantha's somewhat similar. Sam, let's start with this. I had to listen to you. Sam does a podcast herself, which is called Medical Musings with Sam. Is that?
That's correct, yes.
I've remembered something. That's a good start to 2023 for me. I had listened to the first episode of your podcast, which kind of lays out your story, what happened. A couple of times you use this term in there, and I want you to explain yourself because anybody who goes and listens to it is going to have the same question I do. You talk about having chronic illness but being chronically happy. Explain yourself, Sam. How can you have a chronic illness and be chronically happy?
Yeah, and I guess there's another sort of catchphrase, I guess, that I use in conjunction with that, which is chronic illness is a part of your life. It's not all of your life. And that's probably the key in dissecting out what is the chronic illness and who you still are. Because so often we can become just a patient. We can become just our illness because it can be so consuming. And that's a real natural response and an understandable response for anybody dealing with chronic disease. But, you know, I quickly worked out that if I was going to be able to cope with having really complex disease and you know, just a plethora of of symptoms and different diagnoses thrown at me, then I needed to find a space to still be me. And that was where I landed, and I decided, you know, I was so much more than this before my disease. I was an executive manager in financial services. I had an amazing career. I led a huge team of leaders. You know, I wasn't just a patient, and I needed to find ways to take all of those skills and use them in a completely different way. So by doing that, I could still be happy despite horrible pain, despite crazy circumstances, like, you know, my femur breaking in half just walking to my bedroom door, you know, just weird and wonderful things. I just hung on to who I was, and I think that for me has been the absolute key to me being able to cope and survive.
I've been having waking nightmares about that femur breaking story that you told on your podcast ever since. I didn't know such a thing could happen. The temptation, Fran, and I think Sam's done a magnificent job of outlining what I found both with Dean and we're finding with Sam. She's decided that she's not defined by her illness, as Dean didn't, is the danger that the rest of us and clinicians can fall into the trap of thinking chronic condition equals that's what this person is now for their.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we really need to explore this because I think sometimes it's very difficult to know how to approach people who've got chronic medical diseases, because it's like, if they're not talking about it, is it better to sweep it under the carpet and pretend everything's okay? You know, maybe they might be suffering in silence. And I think that's something that I'd like to ask you, Sam. As a medical professional, I'm a podiatrist by trade. How do we interact with people like yourself?
Yeah. Look, I think it's really important. And whether I'm talking to a doctor, a nurse, or a friend even, or a new acquaintance, I always like to, because it's quite obvious that, you know, there's something wrong with me. I like to lay out, I guess, the overarching story as succinctly as I can. But then on the back of that, talk about the things, just like I've done now, about what I do to still be me. And I think that helps, because I think it gives the person you're talking to them permission to talk about life and not just illness. Mm. And coming back to speaking to clinicians, I think it's really important that our medical profession remember that who they are talking to are still a person, that they have a life outside of that consultation room, that there are things that are important to them, whether it even be just their family, you know, their children, their husband, their whatever. I think that sometimes it just becomes too clinical and not wholesome. So I think it needs to have, and I know that there's limited time, especially with consultations, but I think that, you know, if even a couple of minutes can just be spent at the start or the finish of a consultation to talk about the person's life rather than the illness, I think that would make a huge difference to the overarching experience for patients.
That's wonderful advice. And do you know what? I kind of learned that lesson the hard way, if you like. I was doing research in a foot clinic, and every week I would have a group of patients and I would do some ultrasound on their feet. And there was one guy, and he'd been in like 4 weeks in a row, and he's probably about mid-40s, and he had a diabetic foot ulcer. And I just said to him one day, I said, oh, does it get you down a bit? You've had this for a while. And he burst into tears. And he was like, I can't play football with my kids. I used to be a truck driver. I can't work as a truck driver because I have to have my plaster cast on my leg, so I can't feed my family. And suddenly this whole thing came out. And the 4 weeks before, it was like we just had small talk, basically. You know, we talked about, I don't know, sport or something like that. So I think it really is important to give people this opportunity. And it might be that they just want to talk about what they've been doing, what they've been watching on TV, but it might be they want to go a little bit deeper.
Something more there.
Yeah.
This is probably the hardest thing you get asked, and I imagine you get asked constantly, Sam. Can you outline for us quickly or in a pricey form sort of the background of your story? And I know it is long and it is complex, and there was a lot of things happened. Yeah. Well, I think you got the correct diagnosis. But what essentially is the conditional conditions that you sort of have?
Yeah. I try and break it down into three things because it's easier, and it is a movable feast, but it is easier. I basically have rheumatoid arthritis. That's kind of the underlying thing. But the major disease that I was diagnosed with after I was diagnosed with that was basically a rare bone disease, and they can't give it a name at this point. So what happens is my bones are really dense and I have very low bone turnover, and what happens is I do create new bone and it lays down on top of the old bone like everybody else has happened, but my bone then kind of sits on top of that old bone and it just becomes denser and denser and becomes diseased. And the reason we found that out was because in 2014, I was literally just walking to my bedroom door and my left femur just broke in two as if I had been in a major car crash or fallen off a great height, you know, of floors from a building. And it was a miracle that I'm alive because it could have severed my femoral artery. A blessing that my auntie had just arrived from the UK, would you believe, that night, and she was a registered nurse. Had she not been there, we really don't know what we would have done. So, yeah, so from there, all other bone, my right femur broke. It's got two breaks actually in the right femur. The left femur is non-union. I've got breaks all through my feet. And now my spine is basically in the lumbar area collapsing and is unstable as well. Needs surgery, but the integrity of the bones are such that the surgery is unlikely to take. So all of that leaves me, as you can imagine, quite disabled physically. And then on top of that, actually just prior to all of that, I also had a rectal prolapse that couldn't be fixed, and so I have a stoma. And I just found out last week that I now have my abdominal wall has separated by 5 centimetres and right next to my stoma, and all that has kind of herniated into that muscle wall space. So more sort of things lie ahead for me in terms of surgery, et cetera. Look, I've had about, I don't know, 17 surgeries. I've really lost count. So, yeah, it's just that's it in a nutshell. There are other things, but that's it in a nutshell.
I'll come back to the surgery, Sam, because, of course, this is about wounds predominantly what we're talking about. I imagine there's been a lot of dressing and whatnot there. But just to go back to, you can't help, I imagine, but ask yourself sometimes why. That is a laundry list of really awful things to happen to one person. And really unusual things, you know.
One of my specialists came into my hospital room one day and said to me, "What have you done? Like, have you killed someone in a past life?" Because he said, you know, "You're such a lovely lady, and it just doesn't make any sense to me. And and honestly, look, I have had some of my specialists sit in my room and cry with me. I mean, they've just been, in fact, they've cried and I haven't. I've been consoling them. You know, it's just been, I've had a lot of wonderful support, which has been great. And I guess I don't ask why me. And I think that also the key to trying to maintain a sense of well-being, because there's a sense I probably go, well, why not? You know, things happen to all of us in life at some point. And I also look at what I have had, and I have had an amazing life up until the point of all of this happening. And even now, you know, there are still amazing. I never thought I'd get to write a book. That was a dream of mine, and I've been able to do that. You know, I'm connecting with people all over the world through a forum that I've set up for people with chronic illness, and it's amazing. You know, I get such joy from that. Plus, I'm able to help other people through my own story and my own tips, you know, of how I cope. So there are things that are very rewarding. You know, people often say things happen for a reason. I don't know that I'd particularly go down that path. I think it's more things happen and you need to work out a way to deal with those things to live the best life possible, because we only get one life. So, you know, we have a choice of making it worse for ourselves or making it better. So to ask why me is only going to probably put me down a black hole.
It's a dead end.
I mean, it's an amazing outlook to be able to have. And I think, you know, it sounds a bit trite to say it, but you don't have any choice about what life throws at you, but you do have some choice about how you react to it. And it would be very easy, as you say, to go into a black hole. And it sounds like not only have you managed to keep yourself out of a black hole, but you've managed to set up a whole community of people who've got similar chronic illnesses and to support each other. So can you tell us a bit about that? Because I'm sure we've got some listeners that would love to take advantage of this.
Yeah, thanks. It's called Medical Musings with Friends. So everything I do kind of is the whole medical musings thing. So, you know, my blog is my medical musings, and Medical Musings with Sam is the podcast. And then Medical Musings with Friends is my absolute passion. So it's a we have about 1,800 members globally, literally globally. So, you know, everywhere from the US, Canada, England, Ireland, Scotland, New Zealand, Singapore, you name it. It's literally Belgium. In fact, one of my administrators is a gorgeous girl who lives in Belgium. And I have administrators helping me. So I have a guy in Canada, a friend in Australia, a lovely lady in the UK, a lady in the US, and a lady in Belgium. So we all work together so that we can sort of carry over the time zones so that there is somebody there all the time to talk to someone. And the members themselves just support each other beautifully as well. You know, the culture is very much about friendship and community. So there's no anybody's worse than anyone else. It's not about that. It's just about listening to people's stories. And a lot of it is about talking about life and their life, their family, their interests, their hobbies, so that, just like I was saying before, it gives them something to focus on other than the chronic disease. And then obviously if things happen, if they've got surgeries coming up, or, you know, if there's a symptom that's changed, or they're just feeling really down about something, then as a community, we will just, you know, hold that person up and give as much encouragement as we can. We celebrate birthdays, anniversaries, all of those kind of things for members as well. So I really love it. It's just it does as much for me as it does for everybody else.
It's lovely. Is that a Facebook group, Sam? Am I sure?
It is, no. And it's a private Facebook group, okay. So that people need to join, and we're keeping it like that so that it is a place where they can feel safe.
We'll get a link for the show notes in case there is anybody listening who might want to apply to join and become a part of the community. You mentioned you think about 17 surgeries, which is mind-boggling to consider.
I forgot to add them up, sorry. Okay.
Surgeries, of course, equal wounds, and I would imagine that you've had lots of experience with wounds and wound care. Give us a little taste of how that experience has been for you. And Fran tells me you've done a remarkable job of not having issues with your wound.
Yes. Well, I was talking to Sam earlier on in the week when we were talking about what we would talk about on the episode, and I thought 17 surgeries, and remarkably, you've come out quite unscathed, haven't you? And can I ask you, Sam, if you've got rheumatoid arthritis, presumably you're on immunosuppressive medications?
Yes. Yeah, I have been on a gamut of them. I started off on methotrexate and those kind of things. And I am on prednisone. I've been on prednisone for about 10 years. So, you know, even from that perspective, I should be struggling from a wound perspective. And I haven't, which has been an absolute blessing. And I guess, as I was talking, Fran and I were talking about this earlier, and I just really follow the advice of the doctors and the nurses in hospital for a start. And just when I get home from hospital in particular, and some of my, like I've got a rod, you know, from hip to knee and both legs. You can imagine the length of the wound for those particular surgeries. It was literally that long. And I also actually had a hysterectomy in 2008, a total abdominal hysterectomy. So that wound was huge as well. And I remember we came home with steri-strips with that. And, we're just sort of told, you know, as they fall off, just let them fall off and it will be fine. But actually with that, as they fell off, it still kind of didn't look quite right. So we bought some more steri-strips and just stuck them on. When I say we, that's my husband and I. He's my teammate in all of this. But we covered it with betadine just all the time. And I was really fortunate that I had no issues with that at all either. So it's a matter of doing what you need to do in hospital, but then when you get home, making sure that you have the right bandages to replace the ones that were used in hospital if you're told to replace them. One of the key things that I learned was that sometimes you're not meant to replace them. Sometimes it's better to keep the bandages on for a long period of time because it keeps infection out. And there's always that tendency of, you think something looks a bit grubby, that you want to change it. And that can be a real danger to do that if you're not supposed to do that. So it's just really listening and, I guess not thinking you know best, if that makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, and it's really quite simple, isn't it? And I was talking to one of my colleagues and she said she was talking to a surgeon and he had this slogan, which was, inspection leads to infection. So basically, if you keep taking things off to have a peep, that's when infection can get in. So I think, you know, what you've said is basically good wound care is antimicrobials along with wound dressings that are left in place. And that really is the bedrock of not getting an infection. And at ConvaTec, we actually sell those types of dressings that have silver built into them and they're waterproof and things like that. And those have really proven in surgical sites to reduce the incidence of infection. And obviously there's many different types of dressings, but I think it's the principle that you have to go for, which is don't keep monkeying around with it, for want of a better word. I'm so technical,
Sam's
aren't
big
I?
On the Fran's big on the medical terms here.
Well, actually, you mentioned waterproof dressings, Fran, and that's really important as well. One of the things, often in hospital, they don't necessarily always put waterproof dressings on, but what I have learned is to ask before I leave hospital if they could put a waterproof dressing stressing on for me, because then when I get home, I don't have to worry and I can shower without, you know, having, because you know how you have to put plastic over or whatever so you can have a decent shower. And they're more than happy to do that. And that really helps as well, because then you haven't got that issue of getting it wet, you know, and yeah, making it peel off sooner than it should and all of those sort of things. So that's just another tip that I have as well that has really served me well.
Yeah. That's a great tip. And I think, you know, 17 surgeries, you can really say every cloud has a silver lining. You've been very fortunate, but I think good fortune often comes with good wound care.
Yeah, so. Very much so. I think most people, Fran, would find that confronting, would they not? That idea that you don't take a dressing off every day and replace it with a clean one. That would be the assumption of most lay people, I would assume.
Well, it's very counterintuitive, because no one would tell you to leave your socks on for a week, would they? And so I think that what we know is that when we disturb wounds, firstly, wounds can't thermoregulate. So if you keep taking the dressings off, then the temperature of the wound drops and it can't heal as quickly. Secondly, it's an opportunity for bacteria to get in. And, you know, when people are especially doing things at home, you know, nobody lives in a bubble in their house and there's always going to be microbes floating around. And in hospital, there's probably even worse microbes floating around.
No worse place to be than hospital if you're sick, is there? Fran, Sam's touched on, obviously, chronic illness, and this has been a constant in her life for so long. Of course, some wounds are also chronic. We know that. You probably touched on a bit of this earlier when you mentioned your diabetic foot ulcer chap. Can we learn something from Sam's experience, clinicians and patients alike, about chronic, be it wounds or a chronic condition, from what Sam's told you? And it may be that it's not actually to do with the physical, the dressings, or the way we treat the wounds, but it might be about the way we treat the people.
I think, yeah, we have to, as health professionals, understand how to read people, I think, and how to speak with them and kind of check in, I think. And the other thing, I think, is to try and offer people perhaps places where they can get support and advice, because, you know, often peer support is something that's much more important. I can empathise with somebody like Sam, but I can't necessarily stand in her shoes. But there probably are people that can do that because they have a more closely linked experience. So I think sometimes you can be a very interesting conduit. And I remember many years ago when I worked in London, we'd be seeing patients every 10 minutes. So it was by bedlam in the waiting room. But it became almost like a patient support group because they're all sitting there chit-chatting away. And a lot of people would feel better just for sharing their story with somebody who was on a similar journey. And then you'd also get the people who'd be trying to outdo each other with
the competitive illness.
Yeah, it's like, well, I'm on more prednisone than you are. So, so yeah.
You got any thoughts on that, Sam? You've spent a lot of time in offices. And look, doctors, for the most part, people become doctors, and it's a very scientific pursuit. I'm sure in the medical textbooks that you study when you go to university, there's not a lot about people skills. And some of the, you know, we call it bedside manner, I suppose we have for eons. But I think it seems clinicians and medical people are just kind of left to develop that themselves. What's been your experience, Sam, and how important is that?
Yeah. I think just touching on what Frances said about the waiting rooms as well, you're absolutely right. I have made so many connections with people sitting in waiting rooms. In fact, many of the members have actually joined because I've had my business card.
You've been drumming up business while you're in there.
You
is that what you do?
Oh, we'll have to give you some Convatec business cards. You could be a rep if you spend this much time in waiting rooms.
I know, I could, absolutely. But I think I actually like the idea of what you're saying there as well, in terms of every now and again it happens, but not very often, where, you know, and it's obviously there's patient-doctor confidentiality, but I think if a doctor has a patient who perhaps is really struggling and they have another patient who perhaps is in exactly the same situation but is dealing with it perhaps in a slightly different way and could be of assistance, I don't think there's a problem with perhaps talking to both of those patients and seeing if they could perhaps link up and support each other. So it's thinking outside of the box for the specialists or the doctors in that sense, to think, you know what, we could actually do something quite different here from a medical perspective that would give us a sense of healing and well-being that surpasses me handing out pills or whatever else I need to do. Yeah, I think that's kind of something that would be incredibly helpful.
Absolutely. And I remember I've got one of my best friends got breast cancer when she was quite young. They treated it and she's been fine for, you know, 15 years now. But once I had a patient who came in for something to do with her feet, but had just been diagnosed with breast cancer and she was quite young. And I said, you know, I've got a friend, would you like me to see if she might want to talk to you? And my friend was delighted to, because she had a really positive story, and it's good to give someone hope. So I think you can do it, because all you're doing is asking two people separately, and if one of them says no, they're never going to know each other, are they? It's not like you go handing out Samantha Moss's phone number in the waiting room.
So. Give her a ring no matter what. I get the sense, Fran, this is probably a vastly improved area of medical practice over the last few decades and continuing to improve. Would that be fair to say? I suspect we were really bad at this stuff 50 years ago in terms of patient-doctor relations.
Yeah. Human. I think also, especially in medicine, they've kind of changed the way they recruit medical students, for want of a better word. And I think they're looking for a much more rounded individual, whereas before they just wanted the brainiest people. Mm-hmm. And some of the brainiest people would be better off being accountants because they've got no people skills. Or I shouldn't say that, should I? All the accountants will be up.
I was just going to say.
My brother's
we'll
an accountant,
we'll
actually.
Get letters from the CPA now. That'll be
I am a banker, remember?
Don't admit that at parties.
And I have to apologise to my brother, who's an accountant, who does actually have a personality. Some people should not be in the game of dealing with other people because they don't have the right skill set for it. And I think medical schools are now weeding those people out, and they're taking the more rounded individuals that have got this broader skill set that is much more needed. So I think we will see things changing in that regard.
Yeah.
I think, though, as patients as well, we also need to take some responsibility. I've written a blog post about doctor-patient relationships, and I've mapped it out to, running a business in a sense, that, or a team. In terms of, as patients, we, and particularly if it's someone like me who has so many specialists and so many doctors, like, I almost have to manage that whole team relationship to make sure that, X is talking to Y and everything's being passed on. Some of the feedback that I get from, my members and on my forum and just in speaking to people in general is that they don't feel, brave enough to ask questions of their doctors. They don't, or they feel like whatever they're told is gospel. You know what I mean? And I think that as patients, we need to also work to form a good relationship with our medical team. And that can be done really easily by respecting the fact that, as doctors, you do have a short period of time to talk to us. So going prepared, have a list of questions that we want ticked off, and being succinct in that, taking notes so that we remember what you said, which is really helpful, because so often it can be overwhelming and you go away and you're just like, what? Or take someone with you if you feel like, you're not going to be able to remember. So as much as, yes, there are things that doctors can do for us, there are also things that we can do to make that whole relationship work much more smoothly than perhaps it can.
That's a really, really good point. And my dad comes up on this podcast from time to time, right? I've had my brother on.
Now
I've got
brother,
my dad.
That's right, yeah. Who else are you going to
Yeah. I've got quite a small family, don't worry. So anyway, my dad a few years ago had polymyalgia, and one of the markers in your blood is something called CRP that shows how inflamed you are, which is a marker for how bad your polymyalgia is. So I asked him, what's your CRP? And he said, I don't know. And I said, well, ask your doctor. I can't ask the doctor that. And I said, of course you can. I said, it's a number. Just ask him what the number is and ask him if it was higher or lower than last time. Yeah. So anyway, my dad, very sheepishly asked the doctor, and the doctor gave him the number. And then every time he went back to the doctors, he got the number. So then dad, being dad,
spreadsheet.
Excel spreadsheet, there was a graph. The graph was sent to me, but it actually really helped him, because he could see that to start with, his dose of medication was too low and it wasn't shifting. And then they got the medication right and the trend line was going downwards.
There's something generational about that, don't you think, Sam? And I think we've spoken about this before. My mother would never question a doctor. I'd be unlikely to question a doctor, which is a bit unfair. It's a bit what you're saying, Sam. It's a bit unfair on doctors. You've had a whole couple of generations of people who go to the doctor and expect the doctor to solve the problem. I am passive in this exchange. You're going to fix me. That's your job. can't really work, can it?
No, and I think people just honestly don't think that they can ask those questions as well. Look, I have got files of reports. I get all my blood test reports. My GP gives me copies of everything. He knows me so well now that he has them all ready for me. It's like, here you go.
It's the little efficiencies, isn't it? That makes such a difference.
But absolutely.
But I think things like that give patients a sense of power, don't they? Right. Because you can make your own determinations and you can understand, this is why I don't feel so good at the moment because this marker's high or something like that. Yeah. Or, you know, and I think that it's really, really important. And it's funny, I was at a conference yesterday and we had a guest speaker and she said she went for some procedure, some surgical procedure, I can't remember what it was. And beforehand, she asked the surgeon what the infection rate was. And he said, it's between 1% and 5%. And she said, no, what's your infection rate? He was absolutely horrified. And she said, you know, he was just like so taken aback. And she said she only asked the question because her own brother was a cardiologist and told her to ask this guy. And I think she nearly got marched out the room. But, you know, it's fair enough. If you've got a doctor who 50% of his patients are getting infections, you might want to go and find another one.
Goodness. You know, it is so important. And it's a bit like what you were saying about your dad and even tracking it. That's so important. I have actually found things because, you know, there's so many different things going on with me and so many different specialists, because I have the time to look at the results and do research and do reputable research. Like, don't just Google, try and find good research documents. But I've been able to pick things up and say to the appropriate specialist, look, there's a trend here, or this is happening. I have a feeling this or this might need perhaps investigating. They've agreed, they've investigated, and I've been right. So, you know, it doesn't hurt to do that. And even if you're wrong, well, fine. At least, you know, you've raised it and given the doctor a chance to have a think about it, you know.
There's not a doctor left on earth who hasn't had the patient with the Google solution arrived. You're not going to offend a doctor anymore with that, are you? I mean, they're expecting it.
Yeah. I remember when I was a podiatrist, I used to get people that come in and they go, I think I've got a touch of gout. I've looked it up. And I say to them, so this is my diagnostic tool. I said, if I gave you an axe, would you chop your own foot off? And they said, no, why on earth would I do that? And I was like, you haven't got gout. Because if you've got gout, that's what you'd want to do.
Yeah, indeed. I would imagine that for some doctors, there's the people who come in and say, look, I just need you to prescribe this for me. I've already looked it up. I've made the diagnosis and this is what I need. And there's a danger in it going too far. Sam, you've been very generous with your time. All of the things that we've talked about today, whilst there hasn't been a real focus on specifically wounds, I think they're all important, aren't they, Fran? Because one of the themes that keeps bobbing up on this podcast, there's a few of them. One of them is exactly this, doctor-patient relations and the role of the doctor, the clinician, and the patient in healing whatever the condition is, for the most part, in our interest, wounds.
Yeah, and I think we've got some fascinating insights here that will help any health professional that is crossing the path of someone who's got a chronic illness that they're living with to actually interact with them a bit better. And if that's helped, and we haven't touched a right lot on wounds because fortunately, Sam hasn't got a lot of wound excitement to talk about.
Sam's genius.
She's a wound genius. She's a wound whisperer. So,
a wound whisperer.
So, yeah, I think this has been a very valuable half an hour, and it's certainly been an absolute privilege to talk to you, Sam. Thank you very much.
It's been a privilege to be here. Thank you, both of you. Lovely to speak to you both.
Not at all. Before we let you go, Sam, tell people where they can find you. I imagine you're fairly active on social media beyond just Facebook and where your podcast is. We'll put some links in the show notes, but let people know where they can go looking.
Probably the easiest way is through my blog, and then you get all the links to everything on there. So that's you can search it at just My Medical Musings, that's what it's called, or it's www.mymedicalmusings.com.
I shall put that in the show notes so people can just click on it and go and have a look. Fascinating story, inspirational stuff too, Sam, and really been great to chat to you today. Thanks very much. That's it for the second episode of 2023, but we recorded last week's episode last year. Don't tell people how the sausage is made, Fran. Josh. Our first episode back for 2023 in the studio. We'll be back next time here on The Wound Doctors.